To me, that's a serious problem, was and still is. Everybody thinks what they've got is better than what is being proposed. Matter of fact, when I was in research in DuPont, we had a tough time accepting new ideas because, from outsiders, because you never knew where in the DuPont company somebody else had a similar idea, and then you would have a confluence of an outsider's ideas, and then if you got a patent on it, God, the outsider would sue you, right? So we passed up probably a lot of good opportunities because we were worried about that eventually that could lead to a suit.
Now, you went outside for two different processes.
Yeah.
Were you given those marching orders, or was that your decision?
No, they weren't my marching orders. The acrylonitrile process was a low-yield process, and I knew in Elkem that there were better processes for making acrylonitrile, and it didn't take long to get an evaluation on what the hell was the yield from propylene. So that was an internal selling job, which, by the way, as I recall, was not very easy, because you had an entrenched group there that liked what the hell they had. Although, it's funny, I can recall seeing that acrylonitrile plant that DuPont had, the old route. And it was an atypical plant. All the equipment was crowded so much together that you'd have a hell of a time doing maintenance. And I wondered, why was that so? Well, probably because they were trying to keep the capital costs down, and they put the equipment closer together than they should. And that said to me that there's an internal problem with that, aside from having, by that time, the Sohio process, you could get the information anywhere, because there were at least 15 plants around the world. Terephthalic acid process, that was a little tougher haul. Why? Because the textile fibers department didn't want to switch to terephthalic acid, which was what was made by Amoco. They wanted to use dimethyl terephthalate. And I hate to think of how often I spent with the textile fibers department saying, why don't you use it? They came up with a million reasons why they couldn't, and it took them 10 or 12 years before they switched to terephthalic acid. They said it doesn't die right. It's pretty hard to contradict the experts in the field. And terephthalic acid is cheaper than dimethyl terephthalate. But if you're making a lot of money on polyester, so what? And I think DuPont is still the largest polyester producer, I think. I'm not sure of that. So it's tough. You got to be a hard salesman, a persistent, persuasive person. And it also doesn't hurt to be at the top.
Who did you have to sell first?
I had to sell the production people. And that was tough to do. It took a long time. That took months. It had to take months even to make the first visit, because the guys that you had to bring along were guys that were opposed to the idea to begin with. So it took a lot of persuasion and salesmanship to get these guys to agree to at least evaluate another process, just to take a serious look at it. But that's so damn... I've been out of DuPont for 25 years. So my memory is not as good for some of those details.
Was this something relatively new in DuPont, going outside for outside technology? Or had people done it before you?
No, yes and no. In the 20s, DuPont had a lot of money from World War I, and they bought up lots of companies. Matter of fact, I've made the speculation that one of the reasons Carruthers was as successful as he apparently was in inventing nylon was that DuPont bought rayon from the French, and they bought a film manufacturer. And the guys that were on Carruthers' original team, like Julian Hill and Gus Doro and other guys, they knew those businesses. So when the technician said, "Look at this stuff I've got," right, and pulled it, there were guys that could envision. They had experience to envision what the hell could be done with that product. I speculate that if that weren't true, in other words, if Carruthers had invented that, it's hard to say whether that invention would have been recognized. So, yes, DuPont did a hell of a lot of buying in the 20s, took that money that it made, and it bought lots of interesting things. It bought pigments department. Mm-hmm. I think it bought the... I'm trying to think the root. It bought a root that was different than the one that with the sulfate root was the next one they used, and the guys that had the technology had an opportunity to buy the sulfate root. They chose not to buy it because they said it's not as good as what we've got. And NL Industries bought that technology and got, I hate to think of how much money they made. But that's a classic example of the NIH factor. One of the questions I was asked many times after I left Halcon is, I said, why was R&D so successful compared to other companies in Halcon? I said, well, it was a relatively small outfit, and I sat in many a staff meeting where the R&D people sat in on the same meeting with Ralph and the other people that were, and so if the decision went against the R&D, all of the guys in the R&D heard all the arguments. They heard them all. It wasn't relayed to them by three or four steps down, and that made a hell of a lot of difference. I know in DuPont, God, if it were the general management doing like an R&D project, that might be three or four or five levels down. And who's to say what the hell kind of story they told? Mm-hmm. It'd be tough. So that's an important element in R&D is the closeness between the management and the decision-making process and the R&D. The further it is, the less likely it is to be successful. Matter of fact, I made a point that the DuPont was one of the first companies to put R&D facilities in Switzerland. It was a total failure. Why? Because the R&D, while it had a lot of bright guys in it, was a long ways from the people that were going to implement the ideas. There was no good communication. Now, that would not be true today because of email and networking. But the gal from Exxon, they made the same point, that the R&D today is more closely aligned with the commercial objectives. Now, that may be bad. And she said basic research is still largely done by universities rather than R&D, but rather than industrial companies. And that's probably true up to a point. And there has been probably shifting away to commercial objectives, maybe too much in that, but the pendulum swings back and forth.
So you learn how to be a good salesperson during this time period and selling new ideas to...
I think so. I think that's one of the skills. I think to be a good manager, you have to be a good salesman with your own organization. And if you're not, well, you're not going to get very far.
In 1970, you were moved up to vice president.
Yeah. Well, I think DuPont had damn little few titles. We used to compare ourselves with other chemical companies, and the general manager headed up a big business. And I guess some people said, God, why shouldn't he also be a general manager and vice president? So that was changed. Whether that's in contrast with Union Carbide, who somewhere about 10 years earlier, some of the management got enamored with theory Y and Theory X, and God, they had titles galore. A guy was president of production, and that was one extreme, and DuPont was at the other extreme. And I think I've tried to ameliorate that discrepancy somewhere in 1970. So we were general managers and vice presidents. Your job stayed the same. But I've got to tell you, I went to Africa this year. And in 1970, I had planned to go to Africa on safari. And the president of the company was a guy named Ed Kane. He called me up. He said, "Say, you better not go wherever you're going, because we're going to reorganize the DuPont company, and you better stay home and protect your family." And that's when the explosives was changed to polymer intermediates and other. There were shifts made of businesses from one department to another.
Okay. And you maintained that position when the reorganization took place?
Yeah, I did.
It was probably a good time for DuPont to get rid of the word explosives, too, because...
Well, I've got to tell you a story about that. I sold the last black powder plant that DuPont had in the United States, and where the hell was it? It was at the end of the Scranton-Wilkes-Barre Airport. I forget what the hell the name of the town. There was this little black powder. I said, what the hell if one of those alligator planes comes in just when you get an explosion? So... we sold that last plant, but it's interesting that the U.S. Army was still the biggest consumer of black powder in the United States. But it takes about 2 years before the Army could get any money, so they said, look, we can't buy it, but we want it. You find somebody that will buy it, and we'll give them a contract for, I don't know, 5 years. That's the way it was finally done. I don't know who the hell runs it now, whether it's still running. Is it?
When I left Wilkes-Barre, it was. I lived maybe 20 miles from the airport, and every once in a while we'd hear an explosion.
You're kidding.
I remember them clearly.
Yeah.
They wouldn't even let the state police on the company grounds. You know, the reporters would show up, and everything was barred at the plant gates.
Yeah.
Because it was buried back in the mountains there.
Way back.
Yeah.
Well, you know, most DuPont explosive sites are big. They're usually 3,000 to 4,000 acres. For the reason you mentioned, one is you got to store the stuff, and they're stored in bunkers, and those bunkers have to be so many thousand feet apart, because you can propagate an explosion from one to the next. So that sites are big. Matter of fact, when Cy and I almost bought a plant from Ron Polanka, that was in Pennsylvania someplace, that was an old dynamite site. But God, it was full of probably NG. NG lasts forever in underground. And we didn't buy it. There was a formaldehyde plant, which is what we wanted on this site. But it was right in the middle of some other stuff, and we finally walked away with it. But it was a reminder that explosive sites are dangerous, and they stay sitting there forever.
Well, a lot of that existed in that area up there because of the coal mines.
Oh, I know.
So that it all came with the coal mines.
One of the guys that I got to know too well from Wilkes-Barre was Dan Flood. Well, somebody when I was in the Pentagon said, God, we can't buy any more of these Hardboro grates, because the American troops were freezing in their barracks because you couldn't get any spare parts. I said, well, hell, let's buy some Polish coal. Well, Dan Flood heard about it. I got a reaming out like a... He called me into his office. I'd heard about him being an actor. God, but he had this ruffled...
Oh, yes.
God. But I've got to tell you, I said that was Democratic. But John Heinz approved the same damn law about 10 years later before he was killed in that plane crash. So it wasn't Democratic or Republican. It was people reacting to the needs of the constituency in that area. I don't know how much hard coal is really produced in that area.
There's some strip mining going on.
Is there?
But there are no deep mines at all. They're all closed. But we used to smile at the fact that we were shipping coal from Wilkes-Barre all the way to Germany to heat army barracks.
Probably still going on. Yeah.
Dan Flood was a very important person, and
he must have brought a hell of a lot to Wilkes-Barre.
He
must have been congressman there for a long time.
40 years.
Was he that long?
40 years.
And then he got nailed for something. I forget what the hell it was.
They picked him. I don't know what it was, but there's a Veterans Administration hospital there.
Yeah.
Social Security Administration. They control the paychecks of everywhere east of the Mississippi out of Wilkes-Barre.
Is that right?
Yes, he did very well by the area.
He did, yeah.
But he was very powerful. He was head of the House Committee on Defense for a long time, and that's probably why you ran afoul of him.
God, you know, I raised hell with my A's because a couple of times I got into problems with very powerful congressmen who I thought I was, who they thought I was trying to screw them up. Yeah, and I said, God, to my A's, I said, God, tell me who these guys are. Because I tried to shut down a cannon works in Troy, New York, where Rensselaer is. And they'd been making cannons there for, Christ, I don't know, 150 years. I said, what the hell are we doing? By the way, the government wasn't supposed to make cannons. There was a presidential edict or a law that said that had to be privatized. But they were still making cannons. So I tried to shut it down. Well, then I found out that the congressman from the Troy was a very powerful guy. God, don't get in his way.
Did anything change up to the time you went to, we've already started talking about your DOD experience, but up until that point, was after the reorganization, did anything else change? Did you have any other big projects that you accomplished?
No, but that's how I got acquainted with Ralph Landau. Ralph Landau came to me somewhere around 72, and he had developed a process for making ethylene glycol. And DuPont was a logical buyer because it was a key raw material for making polyester fiber. And I guess my view and the view of our people was it was a meritorious process. So in early January 70 or February 73, I was asked to join the government. So I said to Ralph, we'll make this deal. And Ralph wanted to have DuPont buy the ethylene, which was the raw material. Well, in 73, we had the first oil crisis. And in 73, DuPont couldn't get a long-term contract for ethylene. So that's when Ralph turned to Atlantic Richfield, and they put up $200 million to build this plant. That's how I got to know Ralph. Okay. I knew him before that, but not well. We spent a lot of time together. And that's how I got to work for Halcon, because he gave me a call when I'd already left the Pentagon. He said, how would you like to have lunch at Lutece? Well, who's going to pass up lunch at Lutece, right? And he offered me the presidency of his company, and I turned it down because I said, I'm going back to DuPont. I had rented a house in Centerville someplace. And within a week or two, and this is, it shows you how fate plays a part in your life, his partner died, who I never met, a guy named Harry Renberg.
Yes.
He died, and the directors said to Ralph, God, you got to find some warm body. So he came after me with a deal I couldn't turn down. So that's how I got to why I didn't go back to DuPont and why I went with Halcon.
a couple questions about your government experience. First of all, who asked you to at DuPont and why?
Well, Clements was the Deputy Secretary of Defense in 1973. He was Elliot Richardson's deputy. And he had founded a company called SEDCO, which was an oil field drilling and services company. And he was a guy with very strong opinions. He said, Christ, why the hell don't we get somebody, assistant secretaries that know something about the business world rather than guys that help elect the president? So he persuaded a couple of, investment bankers in Texas to do some recruiting. And they must have called, 25 to 50 companies. And DuPont he called up Burl McCoy, who was then chairman of the company, and apparently the Ag Committee thought about that for a long time, about even submitting a name, because I don't know whether you recall this, but in World War I, we were considered the merchants of death, and we put together the Hanford thing in World War II, and God, we got... Matter of fact, we got out of that as fast as we could. So there was a lot of debate in the executive committee about even to submit a name. Well, finally they said, yeah, let's do that. So I got a call from Burl McCoy one day and said, how would you like to go to Washington? I said, that's the last thing in the world I'd want to do. I said, why me? Well, I was responsible for the tritium plant at Savannah River Works, and explosives had a fair number of defense contracts. He said, hell, at least you know the jargon. So after some thought, I said, God, at least I'll go down and talk to Elliot Richardson and see what it's all about. And he's a persuasive. He said, you ought to do something for your country. And at that point in time, when I saw the likelihood of me advancing in DuPont, I said, yeah, 56, that would be an interesting change. But I didn't realize this, but this was during the Watergate days, and the guys were leaving the White House at a great rate, hauled them, and one of the letters I've still got in my files is from John Dean III, which was 29 questions, 28 very specific, and the 29th says, if you haven't written down what may be embarrassing to the Nixon administration, please write it. Well, he was out before I got a chance to send him that questionnaire back. So that's how I got involved. That wasn't my intention. DuPont floated my name before the Defense Department. In fact, I'll never forget, I was sitting in Elliot Richardson's office one day. He said, well, he says, I haven't heard whether you've accepted our offer yet. I said, I haven't been made an offer. Which is the way that the Pentagon is organized. When I first got there, in typical DuPont fashion, I want an organization chart. Guy says, we got 1 million civilians and 2 million military guys. What the hell organization chart do you want? In the Pentagon, there are 27,000 people. I was there a couple of years. I don't think I ever visit all parts anywhere. Any part of all parts of the Pentagon. It's big organization. So that's how I got started. And it took a long time to get through the route, because, as I say, the White House staff that had to approve personnel, presidential appointments, they were all out in their ear. So it took about 2 or 3 months. I'd be going down to Washington, not knowing whether I had a DuPont job or a Washington job. And matter of fact, then Jim Schlesinger was made secretary when Elliot Richardson became attorney general. And the only time I ever went into the CIA was when there were three or four of us that had not been approved by the Senate Armed Services Committee. We were asked to come down to the CIA and interview Jim Schlesinger. So we went up. Only time I've ever been there. So we weren't sure whether this new guy would... By the way, he was an extremely bright guy, but a terrible administrator. And the number two guy really ran the Pentagon, ran the administration, and sharp guy.
I was going to ask, you were an assistant secretary of defense.
Yeah.
How many assistant secretaries
were
there?
At that time, there were 11. But there were four that were more important than the other seven, and I was one of the four. And even though I'd come from a large company, one of the things that just appalled me was we used to meet, it was called a DSARC, and don't ask me what DSARC stands for because I can't remember. But we used to meet once a week on approving military projects. Which varied anywhere from $1 billion to $5 billion, somewhere in that range. And I was one of the four guys. There was a secretary of research and development, assistant secretary was one guy. The comptroller was another guy. I was the third guy, and the fourth guy was the head of, that was set up by McNamara, the head of analysis and evaluation. But God, you'd get briefings and you'd approve a project that was, say, $1 billion to $5 billion, and most of the times I didn't understand the presentation because the acronyms were so horrendous. But it gave you some feeling for the magnitude of the Defense Department. At one of these sessions, there was a young guy, probably about 25 or 6 years old, and he said, "We ought to spend a little money on this project." I said, "What do you mean by a little money?" He said, $50 million. Well, DuPont, $50 million is a lot of money, but the R&D budget in the Pentagon at that time was $16 billion. It's about $35 billion. So this was a small... It gave you some feeling for scale.
Yeah.